Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Drunkandra, where I live, has numerous links to writers, for people like me who enjoy strolling through its quiet, moonlit streets. My bedroom overlooked James Joyce's childhood home before a developer demolished it. Stephen Dedalus jokes in Portrait of the Artist that the best English is spoken in Lower Drunkandra. I often think that some of the best English was written there too, as I pause on the rise to imagine the children's writer Patricia Lynch growing old there with her husband, the socialist historian R.M. Fox, writing her classic books and ordering weekly provisions from Finlater's, the famous grocery store. On Church Avenue, I think of a young Val Mulkerns growing up there with novels on her head. Then I look across at St. Patrick's Teacher Training College, where John McGarren learned to be a secret subversive, in a college where, as he recalled, there was something considered wrong and dangerous and idle about reading books except to pass exams. The college has radically changed since then, but the house where I always pause on my walk is further up and connected with a poet rarely associated with Drunkandra, the poet Patrick Kavanagh. People associate him with Monaghan and with the Grand Canal near Baggot Street, which Kavanagh turned into an imaginative fiefdom. Kavanagh spent his later Dublin years colonising Baggot Street, commencing every day by visiting the hospitable ladies of Parsons' bookshop, who fortified his morning tea with a baby power. But Kavanagh's first home in Drunkandra was a flat on Upper Drunkandra Road, in a house where, some years ago, a discreet plaque was erected, thanks to enthusiasts like author Brendan Lynch and Peter MacDonald of the Monaghan Association. In August 1939, Kavanagh moved into this flat with his younger brother Peter, the brothers forking out 7 shillings and 6 pence to purchase a stretcher bed for Kavanagh to sleep on. Or perhaps Peter forked out, because while Kavanagh harboured prospects of a dazzling literary career, he was and remained singly short of money. But Kavanagh was singly lucky in possessing a brother with absolute faith in him, willing to bankroll him while he worked on his novel Tavy Flynn. A few doors down from Kavanagh's flat was number 37 Upper Drunkandra Road, where Professor John Carolyn of St. Patrick's College was murdered by British soldiers during the Black and Tan War. But another war preoccupied Kavanagh's thoughts and profoundly affected his future, because weeks after moving into his flat, Kavanagh encountered a newsboy on Drunkandra Road selling a newspaper with one word on the cover: war. Kavanagh had recently left London, where he was acquiring a reputation, until his memoir, The Green Fool, was subject to a libel action. His brother had only purchased the cheap stretcher bed because Kavanagh had ambitions of returning to London, ambitions thwarted by the advent of war. Who knows where Kavanagh would have ended up if the outbreak of war hadn't meant that his Drunkandra flat became the first of many Dublin addresses. Peter, working as a teacher, realised that his brother was suddenly, in Antoinette Quinn's phrase, a semi-permanent non-contributory guest. With only one salary between them, a cheaper flat was sought on Haddington Road. But Kavanagh's precarious financial circumstances improved when, with his stretcher bed barely cold in Drunkandra, he became the first winner of the prestigious AE Memorial Award. As I was the final recipient of this award in 1985, given once every 7 years to the best young writer under the age of 25, and as John McGarren also received this largesse when barely out of St. Patrick's College, it could be said that this once famous award had its beginning, middle and end in Drunkandra. Kavanagh also received support from a normally censorious fellow Drunkandra resident and fellow Ulsterman in exile, the imperious Archbishop John Charles McQuaid. McQuaid, in turn, also fled his palace in Drunkandra for the south side. Kavanagh remembered his Drunkandra flat with wry affection in his poem, I Had a Future. Show me the stretcher bed I slept on in a room on Dunkonda Road. Let John Betjeman call for me in a car. I doubt if Betjeman's ghost turns up in a car, but I touch my cap every night I pass that Dunkonda house where two Monaghan brothers once talked late into the night about their dreams of the future.
I never went to college. I have no degree in anything but life, and sometimes that rankles. I wonder would I be smarter had I graduated from a university as opposed to a school. Then I remember some very foolish people have letters after their names, and I think I'm fine. Still, I have long daydreamed about having the opportunity to sit for hours in a lecture theatre and listen to a learned person expound on matters that interest me. Feminism, modern history, philosophy, psychology. I fantasize about having my mind stretched and bent by learning, by new ideas and different views. In normal times, I would sate this particular appetite by attending many of the cultural and arts events this country is steeped in. But there are no events to attend in person just now. Nowhere much to go, not even college. As someone who previously had the house to myself during the day and enjoyed the peace and quiet of working alone with only a cat or two for company, I now find myself marooned in a house that has become a busy hub. My husband is here, when normally he would be out on photographic assignments. My daughters are here, when they should actually be attending college. Instead, they're in their respective rooms, logging on to the lectures and tutorials. My kitchen, which has been an oasis of calm, of coffee, of the morning newspaper, of a lunchtime sandwich, of my book, now regularly feels like a crowd has just passed through, like Houston Station after the Cork train has departed. Countertops strewn with coffee cups, plates of crumbs, knives smeared with butter, all of which somehow manage to make their way near the dishwasher, but never quite into it. Lunchtime can be challenging as the students descend from above to open the fridge and cupboards and announce that there is nothing to eat in the house. Like I should be running a cafe with a menu for them to choose what they might like to have today. I don't run a cafe. I'm still wondering why they think I do. But it's the voices that are the most unnerving. Strange voices. I hear them on the landing when I go upstairs, pouring out through bedroom doors left slightly ajar. Voices, some of which still boom, even though their lecture hall or theatre is for now no more. Voices asking questions, holding forth, urging, cajoling and attempting humour. Sometimes I stop and listen. And sometimes I feel sorry for these academics, used to delivering their insights in a room energised by real students, where they can gauge the reaction to their words. Now their greatness is reduced to talking to a screen, which must often be more like Shirley Valentine's wall than a lecture hall. As for me, in a house that has seen very few visitors in the last 9 months, having all these new people in the ether is disconcerting. Almost as disconcerting as the fear that periodically infects us that the broadband or the Wi-Fi will sit down. Outside walls, blind spots, routers, boosters, all feature in conversations about it and mean that sometimes the girls move about in order to get the best signal. My middle one arrived into my office, which I share with himself, the other day, thinking that we had somehow managed to secure all the broadband in our workspace. She cleared a desk and began to study. After an hour, she announced that it was impossible. Not because of the broadband, but because of the sound of my typing out what she called my little thoughts, and himself trying to sell photos of Dunleary while she was engaged in the more serious business of trying to get an actual degree. But at least she's gone back to her bedroom. Sometimes I think that instead of trying to craft my so-called little thoughts into some kind of coherent narrative, I should grab a cushion and sit on the landing, taking notes on whatever lecture is underway. And then I think how much more fun it would be to crash into their room, acting the maggot, or just collecting all their dirty washing, making lots of noise to mortify them and amuse the others participating in the online event. I have managed so far not to give in to this particular urge, but it remains a tantalising antidote to the stress of this new living, working and studying at home.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's Cacciatore, Dore.
In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell and the doors to Eastern Europe started to open. The following year, I flew from our small island off the west coast of Europe and eventually landed in Warsaw Airport. It felt like you were entering the history of Tolstoy's War and Peace, Chopin, then two world wars, then the fall of communism. When you arrived, you first had to declare yourself and the money you carried, given a slip of paper testifying to your few banknotes and traveller's checks. You then cleared passport control. Next step was into a melee of taxi drivers anxious for a fare. The toughest or meanest won. That was before the taxi rank concept was adopted sometime later. On the way into town to an office on a street appropriately named Novi Sviat, New World, you noticed the absence of advertising. A year later, the ads appeared, along with insurance salesmen. You didn't need a paper life insurance policy under communism. Other things could assure your safety, depending on your rank in the classless society. I got a place to stay in an official government hotel. A soldier with a gun was controlling the gate. Across the road was the Russian embassy, which was slightly unsettling. Next door to the hotel was the Belvedersky Palace. As I passed by on my walk into town to work on the first morning, I saw a beautiful peacock strolling the grounds of the palace. The current resident was Lech Walesa, the new president of Poland. At the hotel, there was no rasher and egg for breakfast. Rather, the breakfast was what you would call Eastern Continental. I took a boiled egg and toast with a coffee on the side. Life went on like that until one morning I came down to no toast. When I asked, I was told that the toaster was not available that morning. When I inquired why, I was told that Vaclav Havel had it, as he was visiting and staying in one of the bungalows in the grounds of the hotel. He liked toast, so I did without for a few mornings while he made plans with Lech. At that time, Ireland had established a new embassy in Warsaw, and the ambassador, Dick O'Brien, was playing a blinder. He was opening doors where there weren't even doors. The St. Patrick's Day celebrations were added to the Polish festive calendar, and Irish-Polish relationships haven't looked back. The centre of Warsaw looks ancient, but is actually a faithfully reconstructed centre that was rebuilt after the Second World War. In 1944, the Germans blew up most of the buildings as they retreated. As the Russians had obligingly stayed on the far bank of the Vistula, while the short-lived and brave Warsaw Uprising was put down by the German army. While all that was happening, we Irish were living through an emergency where Dubliners went to cut turf for winter fuel in the Wicklow featherbeds on the weekends. It was fascinating for me to see the range of vodkas on offer. I still have a bottle that has gold flakes in it. Naturally, the brand name is Goldwasser. I'm keeping it as a hedge against a future recession. Another one had a blade of bison grass in the bottle that imparted a very unique and pleasant flavour to the vodka. That one, called Zubrovka, was a favourite and still is. That particular type of aromatic grass is also favoured by the last of the European bison that roam in eastern Poland, close to the border with Belarus and Ukraine. That border has moved a few times over the centuries. The city of Lvov, for example, was claimed by Poland, then the Austro-Hungarian Empire, again by Poland, then the Soviet Union, and then by Ukraine, where it remains today. The city has also changed its name from Lvov to Lemberg, back to Lvov, and now Lviv. The Irish were also there in the first millennium AD. The city has traces of Irish monks, as noted by Pope John Paul II when he visited Clonmacnoise in 1979. I believe that the Irish monks came from here and went as far as Lvov and brought with them Christianity. That is why Catholics in Poland and in Ireland are not just similar in their faith, but identical. And for this gift of the faith to Poland, I today thank God in this sacred place. Lvov was also a very multicultural city before the Second World War, and Jews represented 32% of the population, having lived there for at least 300 years. All that remains now is one active synagogue, serving the 0.3% Jewish population. That November night when the Berlin Wall fell, the light of freedom and democracy shone through the darkness. Let it continue to shine on.
Carnegie Library stands as a single-bay, two-storied building with box-oriel windows on the main street in Capuquin. It is a building out of context with the streetscape. That was where I spent any free time I had growing up. Mrs. McLaughlin, the librarian, indulged my passion for books. She was always generous in the allocation of books, assured that they would be returned well in advance of the due date. My father did not allow television in our house. It was here that I found the book that changed my life. My mother came from Lismore, and her family knew of D'Urville Murphy, the writer of Wheels Within Wheels. William Trevor's notes on the back cover stated, "An extraordinary book, reflecting an extraordinary woman and one of the great travellers of our time. All the things I wanted in my life were there in that one sentence. At that time, I needed an extraordinary book. I wanted to be an extraordinary woman. And above all else, I wanted to travel the world." Her world in West Waterford was so close to mine, and I knew I could go to the places she wrote about. A round trip up to the Knockmildown Mountains, to Baylock, and freewheel down the Vee. A cycling trip to England and Wales, including Stratford-upon-Avon, and a 5-week cycling tour in Europe were all the things I dreamed about. The only problem was that D'Urville Murphy travelled by bike and I didn't have one that I could use, save for my father's old rusted bike with a crossbar that I had to navigate awkwardly to cycle. It was a rather unbalanced ride. Sometime later, the gods favoured me in the strangest of ways. I was coming home one evening from a camogie match, walking up the street to my house, when I saw money on the pavement outside the post office, which was closed for the evening. I picked it up and saw it was a £100 note. It was an astonishing sight. I had never seen one of these before. I was rich. That is until I got home and shared the excitement with my parents. They were very clear. It wasn't mine to keep. I had to take it to the church, to the sacristan, Paddy Carroll, and hand it in. He told me there was a law that said if nobody claimed it in a year and a day, it would be mine. Whether or not that was true, I wasn't sure, but I was bitterly disappointed. How could I wait a year? Troy's bicycle shop on Main Street had in its window an orange colour rally bike with leather seat and dropped handlebars. That was the bike I wanted. I asked the owners of the bike shop to keep it for me for 366 days. They said if nobody bought it before that, they would. That year passed more slowly than any other of my life. Regularly, I marked the days off on a calendar at home, hoping and sometimes praying that nobody claimed the money or that the bike wasn't sold. There is no doubt that I must have sorely tested the patience of the sacristan and the bike shop owners over and over during that time. My life was on hold. I reread Wheels Within Wheels so many times. I imagined a life of complete freedom if I only had the orange rally bike. I saw myself cycling to Brussels and Bonn, up the Rhine and cycling through Paris. I craved for the solitude and silence and the dramatic landscapes D'Urville Murphy wrote about in Spain. I admired her bravery and freedom. I soaked up more of D'Urville Murphy's books, A Place Apart about the North of Ireland, and Full Tilt, Ireland to India with a Bicycle. Northern Ireland was a different world to me, but I knew the bike would get me there. I knew the freedom it would bring. India was also on my list, along with the rest of the world, but it all hinged on whether or not the money was claimed. Winter turned to spring, then to summer. Finally, the day arrived. At 8 a.m., I was standing outside the church waiting for it to open. I waited for the sacristan to arrive, and indeed, true to his word, he went to the safe, took the envelope with my name on it out, and handed it to me. The money was mine. I ran to the bicycle shop, and there it was. Nobody had bought it. The bike was purchased, and I had £5 extra to spend. My life had begun, and I knew I could go anywhere I wished. In the first couple of years, I followed the River Blackwater, cycled over the mountains, took trips to most of Southern Ireland, and eventually got to cycle in England. I shall never forget the sense of being alive and free in those early trips. Bikes have always meant freedom to me. They still do. And D'Urville Murphy has always remained an extraordinary woman and my hero.
Most working days, I cycle my late father's High Nelly bicycle into Croke Park. Despite the architectural modernity of the stadium, the vintage bike fits comfortably in its environs and rests easy there. I brought the bicycle to Dublin following my father's death in 2011, the year I started working in Croke Park. Much like my father, it is a rare specimen, even by the norms of rare things, and twice I have been stopped on Dublin's busy streets by enthusiasts seeking a closer look at its distinctive crossbar design. As a birthday present, a friend sent it to be fitted out for a new front brake set to a mechanic known for vintage bike restorations. He dated it to about 1913, the year the Gaelic Athletic Association purchased the grounds on which Croke Park now sits. The bicycle forms part of the GAA mythology. Before the rise of the automobile, the Freedom Machine enabled our games to spread beyond neighbouring parishes and allowed youngsters see in the flesh the intercounty stars that before resided soundly in the airwaves and purely in the imagination. They returned to great prominence and importance during the Second World War, when fuel shortages saw a generation return to the saddle to keep our games peddling. A cursory exploration of the GAA Oral History Project, commissioned by the Association as part of its 125th anniversary celebrations in 2009, reveals amongst the 790 interviews conducted with GAA fans, players and administrators, an assortment of references to our great emancipator, the bicycle. The humble bike also provided past generations with a boast second only to claiming the All-Ireland title itself. I cycled to Dublin to watch that game. I have heard that declaration from men from the four provinces. For swathes of the population, the GAA serves as an almanac, marking their calendars as accurately and as emotionally as their children's birthdays. When your working life too synchronises with its seasons, milestones appear both on the horizon and in your rearview mirror with heartbeat regularity. But some, such as the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, cause your heart and head to pause. Reflecting on the recent work by my colleagues in commemorating the centenary of Bloody Sunday, I was cast back to my 10-year-old self, the sports-mad boy sitting distractedly in national school, waiting for history to end so I could escape again outside to play. I recall hearing how 14 of those who attended a game in our national stadium never lived to kick another ball or see another match, including Tipperary player Michael Hogan. I realised that I was the same age then as Jerome O'Leary, the youngest victim of the massacre, who was shot in the head and killed. You appreciate that history is not just a thing of the past, but something that shines a light on your understanding of your world, your identity and our games. I ponder a lot of things when I'm cycling. Coming up Clonliffe Road and watching Croke Park emerge over the rooftops of the street's red brick houses and cottages, I wonder how many of the 5,000 spectators that made it to Croke Park on Sunday, November 21st, 1920, journeyed by bicycle. A fair swathe, no doubt. It was the tail end of the golden era of cycling in Ireland, and Croke Park had even hosted bicycle races by then. A match between Tipperary and Dublin, two of the top teams of the era, would have seen country roads and city streets deliver processions of elegant High Nelly riders to Jones's Road, their individual journeys ending in a collective destination, black swans arriving unwittingly to a black swan event. Michael Collins was a good man for the bike. My brother Ollie restored as a wedding present for my wife a beautiful Raleigh High Nelly, built according to the serial number, in their factory on Hanover Quay, Dublin, in 1947. He accompanied it with a framed copy of the famous photograph of the big man standing proud beside his Rudge Whitworth bike, custom made in 1919. For a revolutionary, it was an ideal mode of transport in a city awash with comparable bikes. One could dissolve into a crowd or fleetly flee from the scene of an assassination, finding oneself in minutes on the other side of the city. The Freedom Machine remains the only way to traverse this historied old city. When travelling by bicycle, you are part of your environment, cultural and built, rather than looking at it through yet another screen. It offers immediacy, intimacy and connection. My jaunts around the city and to my office in Croke Park involve less subterfuge than those made by the big man and his 12 apostles. The only revolutions are off the cogs and wheels, or in my mind. Nonetheless, as I slip from the outside world and freewheel up to the staff bike rack buried deep under the Hogan stand, I remember that there is more to this place than just a name.
Bitter legend. When the Jews were expelled from Spain, they travelled east. After many days, they stopped to rest. a message dropped down from the sky. Polin, it said in Hebrew. Stay here. That is how Poland got its name.
On this morning's programme, we heard Kavanagh in Drumcondra by Dermot Bulger, Voices in the Ether by Barbara Scully, Václav Havel Borrowed the Toaster by Frank Kavanagh. The book that changed my life for Dervla Murphy's birthday by Hannah Kiley. The Revolutions of Wheels and the Wheels of Revolution by Colin Regan. And Bitter Legend, a poem by Vincent Woods. This morning's music began with Hear My Song, Violetta, sung by Joseph Locke. Then we heard Everybody Eats When They Come to My House by Cab Calloway. After that, Etude in C, Opus 10, Number 1, The Waterfall Etude by Chopin, played by Vlado Perlemutter on piano. Then we heard In Bicicletta by Luis Bacalov from the film Il Postino. And finally, Broken Bicycles by Tom Waits. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from this and other RTE culture programmes, go to rte.ie/culture.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.